Welcome to SFF Yeah, a podcast dedicated to all things science fiction and fantasy. This is episode 149, and we are recording on March 3rd. I'm Jen Northington, here with Sharifa Williams, and today we are doing a book club discussion for Lone Women by Victor Lavelle, which is actually not out until March 28th. Sorry, not sorry. We wouldn't normally pick a book that was not out yet to book club, but we did. I don't have any other explanation for it than we just did.
It was irresistible. And I guess this will appeal to people who don't really care much about spoilers. And we will, as usual, you know, start out with non-spoilery stuff so that at least people can listen to a good chunk of the episode.
Yes. We will be very clear. And really, this is just like our probably you should read this book when it comes out pitch.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll get more into that after we do some announcements and some news. So let's see. All right. So an announcement. We have a brand new fancy thing. It is a Substack exclusive newsletter called The Deep Dive. And it is full. It is going to be full. We just launched it. It's going to be full of fascinating stories, informed takes, advice, and more from experts in the world of books and reading. So, we're tapping our in-house experts to, like, you know, talk to y'all about all of the things that they know. We're going to look at lesser known histories in books. We're going to talk about experiences as readers, all of that good stuff. So the paid level is $5 a month. And you get it in your inbox twice a month. And if you are on the fence or need some time to think about it, there is a free subscription level that will get you the splash pad. Side note, love the names of these.
They're so fun.
It's so fun. And that's going to have some like recommended reading, bookish lifestyle goods that we're excited about, you know, fun stuff monthly. So did I miss anything, Sharifa? You've been working on this a lot.
Yeah, that covered it really. We have a long think piece on Colleen Hoover from Jeff. So we've already got some good stuff in there for anybody who subscribes and wants to look back at the archive and, you know, read some really interesting articles from Jeff and Rebecca, both who sent some in. So
nice.
Just I encourage everybody to go and hit that subscribe button.
Yes. So you can do that at bookriot.substack.com. All right. We will now do a sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at heroquest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is the graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at heroquest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Gillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden, and thanks again to W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
All right. So I will be kicking off our news segment, and I wanted to start with some really cool news. This is coming from Vibe, reported on by Amber Corinne, and it's about Eve L. Ewing, who is going to become the first Black woman to write one of the main Black Panther comic series. And I just wanted to mention, and I love this, that Ewing talked about some of the other great Black writers who have worked on aspects of the Wakanda universe. She mentions Roxane Gay and Nnedi Okorafor, and who else did she? Yona Harvey as well. So she gave a shout out to the Black women writers who have worked in the Wakandan space, as she calls it, and just talks about her general excitement and enthusiasm about the great Black women, Black non-binary writers, and great people of color who have worked at Marvel and sort of paved the way for her to be able to work on this comic. And Ewing has been working in comics for some time. So she's written Ironheart. She wrote Ironheart in 2018. And this is obviously huge news. And it's kind of like so wild to me that this is like the first Black woman writer working on the main Black Panther comics. But I am so excited for her. She's obviously been doing a lot of work in comics for a long time, and this sounds hugely deserved. I can't wait to see what she does with the comics. She did mention that she's not necessarily rebooting the story, but building on what's already existing in the Wakanda universe, and also introducing some really cool new things. And so everybody who loves the comics, who loves Wakanda and T'Challa, I think this is like some really great news, and I definitely encourage everybody to read more about Ewing and what she's doing in the comic space. There are lots of links to other stories where she's done interviews, so super cool. I'm really excited for her.
Very, very cool. I gotta catch back up with Black Panther. I have not read it since, gosh, the Ta-Nehisi Coates run, and I didn't finish that one. I'm so behind on comics in general, actually. Okay, but the thing I want to note here that I learned from this article, in addition to, obviously, general excitement about Ewing's getting to write the main Black Panther comic, is that Black Panther was originally called Cole Tiger.
Yeah.
Which I had no idea. And I was like, oh, wow. And it's so funny to me. I've been thinking about it ever since I read this article. Like, Cole Tiger to Black Panther. It's not actually that far, but it makes a world of difference.
Yeah. I was surprised by that as well. I do not know a lot of the history of Black Panther, but that sort of took me out a little. Like, I was like, wait, what?
That makes
all the difference in the world. I am glad they didn't stick with that name. Yikes. I will say that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So yes, super excited about that one as well.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying to decide where to go next. Here's a head scratcher. I am just like, I just can't even with this. So this story is from Variety, reported on by Matt Donnelly. And they have announced that there are going to be new Lord of the Rings movies from Warner Brothers. The word this article specifically uses is revamping the Lord of the Rings film franchise. They're going to make multiple films based on the Lord of the Rings books specifically, which is already been done, obviously. And like, I am just scratching my head about this one. Like, they talk about how they're like, oh yes, we're like talking to Fran Walsh and Peter Jackson and Philippa Boyens about it. And like, you know, we can't wait to hear their vision, which is like a very diplomatic response to this. But it's bananas to me that like there's so much material. I mean, memorably, you know, we had the Rings of Power, which was working on, you know, I think from the Silmarillion as well as other back matter, lesser known, you know, stories from the Middle Earth, you know, worlds that Tolkien has created. But for them to be like, oh yeah, yeah, we're gonna redo Lord of the Rings. Like, and they talk about in the piece how there are still bits of those books that didn't make it on screen, which like is obviously true, but none of those bits are standalone, right? Like, you can't have, I mean, just there's all kinds of pieces of like Tom Bombadil. Let's talk about Tom Bombadil for a second. You can't have a Tom Bombadil segment without Frodo, right? Like, or I guess you could, but like, what would it be connected to if you don't have the Fellowship involved in that moment? So like, I am just so sort of head scratchy about this. I want them to stop rebooting things and make other things. That's what I want in life.
I feel that. I truly don't know what they're like. I was like, what are we doing? What are we doing with this work right now? Like, we're just seeing so much stuff come out, like so many people doing reboots and revamps and, you know, trying to squeeze the life force out of series. And Lord of the Rings is one of those, like, it's just endless, the stuff they tried to pull out of this. And we've obviously seen, like, some failures happen here. And I'm just like, I know that these movies happened technically a while back, but it doesn't feel that long ago. And I'm like, at least give it, like, a few decades, maybe, like it just feels like it hasn't been enough time. And we've also just had, you know, Lord of the Rings stuff crammed down our throats. I'm just like exhausted by it. Yeah. So,
and you know,
I don't know.
Like, I'm not against reboots or revamps in general. I think there's a lot of actually really interesting updating to do to a lot of older properties, but those are from like longer ago than 2003. Like, this is like barely 20 years in the case of Return of the King. And it just doesn't, and especially because this, I mean, I don't know. There are things I wish they had done in those movies, but do I believe that Warner Brothers is going to do those? Like, do I believe they're going to cast more diversely amongst like elves and hobbits? Like, maybe, but like, what else are you going to do with it? And also, are you going to, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I agree with you. It feels too soon. And also, I would just like spend your money on something else, please. And thanks. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway. My guess was going to be they're just going to like have a completely different cast and spend way more money this time than they did last time. Like, that's all I can imagine for this.
I mean, you're probably right. So anyway, we're super skeptical about that one in case you were wondering.
Come on now. All right. Well, I wanted to talk about, I guess, a thing that makes me feel a little bit more conflicted than I feel about the Lord of the Rings stuff. And it comes from The Guardian, reported on by Sarah Shafi. And it's about some rediscovered Terry Pratchett stories that are going to be published. So these are stories, 20 of them, that were written under a pseudonym Terry Pratchett had. And so these stories have never been attributed to Terry Pratchett. And they were discovered through really interesting circumstances by a Pratchett fan, a few Pratchett fans, actually. So one of the stories in this collection that were previously published was The Quest for the Keys. That's the name of the story. And this Pratchett fan, Chris Lawrence, had saved this story and literally like framed it, put it on his wall. It's been there for more than 40 years. And then I guess out of the blue, he thought to let the Pratchett estate know about its existence. And from there, the rest of the stories were discovered, or, you know, unearthed is the word they use here, by a couple of other fans, Pat and Jan Harkin, who did a bunch of research to find the other stories. And now they're going to be published for the first time under Pratchett's name. And these are not Discworld stories. They are not set in Discworld, but apparently they hint at some of the world, at some of what Terry Pratchett is really known for, as it relates to Discworld and, you know, just his whole world building, really. So the reason I feel like vaguely conflicted, maybe it's too strong a word, but, you know, Terry Pratchett famously had his unpublished work steamrolled,
yes,
like literally destroyed, and did not want any of that stuff to come out. Obviously, that was the reason for it. These were previously published, so it doesn't, yes, really apply. So technically, it's not a big deal. I don't know if, like, I'm just so curious, like, if Terry Pratchett was around today, like, what he would think about it being unearthed, because he obviously didn't mention the work when he was around in his later years with Discworld. It remained under a pseudonym, not attached to him. But apparently, according to this piece and people who know him, you know, he just has always been a great writer, and the stories are really excellent and, you know, give you the feel of Pratchett. So I don't know. Like, I'm curious. I haven't finished Discworld, so I feel like I should probably continue reading those books before I, like, fall on these unpublished works. But I'm also, of course, as a Pratchett fan, super curious about what his early writing looked like and, you know, just to see how he developed as a writer. Because as a writer, I'm always fascinated by that with authors that I really admire. But I don't know. I think this is an interesting one for Pratchett fans. And I'm so curious about how it'll do, like, if it'll sell and if people will be as enthusiastic. I know.
I think it'll. I mean, I don't have any doubts that it'll sell personally. Like,
yeah.
And I do. I feel you. I mean, to me, it was like, okay, these were already published. So I do see the argument for it not coming under, you know, the his last wishes about unpublished work. But it's fascinating, you know, they were published in a newspaper, you know, they weren't collected in a book. They were not published in, like, literary magazines. They were serialized in newspapers. So, and there weren't, like, you know, they were not considered part of his works by anybody other than obviously him and now these fans who, like, I guess knew about the pseudonym. That's the part that I wish The Guardian went into more specifically. Oh, yeah. Is like, did he publicly acknowledge the pseudonym? Like, is that generally publicly known? Was it a secret? Like, that's the part that I'm sort of curious about. But I'm 0% surprised that they will collect them and publish them.
Yeah.
And it will, I have no doubt that they will be very popularly sold. I do agree with you. It's super interesting to see a writer's evolution. And it would be interesting to see how these compare to Discworld. But I also understand it's like, he kind of didn't want anything published after he died, is one way to interpret that. And this would be not quite honoring that. So I see your conflict is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I obviously would not judge anybody for buying this collection. I will probably end up picking it up at least to put on my TBR because I can't help myself.
Yeah, I was going to say there's no way you're not reading them, right? Like
yeah.
You're going to read
yeah.
them. So here we are. All right. So our last story is one. Oh, gosh, y'all.
Yeah.
I have so many thoughts and feelings about this. I'm going to try to keep it concise. This is also from The Guardian. And it was reported on by Alex Hearn. And the sci-fi publisher Clark's World, which is like a very long running, you know, short story publisher in science fiction, very well respected, like memorable. That has also given a lot of writers their first start because it's one of the few publications that always has open submissions and accepts short stories from new writers without, you know, asking them to pay, and it pays. Like Clark's World is sort of, you know, unique among short fiction publications for those reasons. And that's why it's a big deal that they have had to close their submissions because they were flooded with AI generated short stories. And, you know, it's not great. Neil Clark is the founding editor, and he was like, you know, we used to get like a couple of these, and then in February, we had more than 500. It has, like, the release of ChatGPT has, like, really increased this. And it, to be clear, this is not, you know, these are, like, scammers. They're just trying to get paid. This is not, I don't think, like, actual new writers like trying to, you know, whatever, like these are people who are trying to scam and get paid and not be like part of the sci-fi community, part of, you know, the speculative community, trying to make a career for themselves. For the most part, I'm sure there are some folks out there doing that too, but mostly these are side hustle people is what Clark has said, and I'm sure that that's true. And there's all kinds of controversies going on right now around AI generated content. I didn't even realize this, but the article notes that the Colorado State Art Fair awarded first prize to an image created by Midjourney, by a person named Jason Allen, who like was the one who like typed the prompt in, and they like, you know, this, he got first prize for this art. And there was a thing that happened with Tor.com where they realized that one of their covers had been created using AI generated art, which is not like AI generated art is based on the art of other artists who have not authorized it for that use. So that's, you know, art plagiarism functionally. So Tor is working on screening that now for their cover images. And they're not the only ones who are having to grapple with this. Everybody across publishing is having to deal with the art, the, you know, stories, the words, like it's all, I mean, we're talking about it in-house. So there are ways in which AI generated text is huge for all kinds of things, a very useful tool. And then there are ways where it's a huge problem for publishing, and this is one of those ways. So functionally, Clark's World can't reopen until they have figured out how to weed these out without a human being having to go through each and every one of them and reject them, which is unsustainable on, you know, the shoestring budgets and resources and staffing that these publications traditionally have. So it's going to be real interesting. I'm going to be following this story as much as possible because, yeah, how do you solve a problem like ChatGPT to paraphrase The Sound of Music?
It is a monumental task. Like, I know people are trying to sort out this puzzle across industries, like where plagiarism and AI generated whatever isn't what they're trying to produce and offer. So I am really curious about what kind of solution they're going to find. And you know, they talk about this, and you talked about this, that they pay people who are new to publishing their stories, people who are trying to get into this world as writers. And one of the things about Clark's World is that they do pay professional rates, and professional rates give you access to all sorts of things, yes, like memberships in writing associations and things. It's like one of the gates that kind of bar you from access to those things. So it is hugely important, not just for the money, but for like having access and support as a writer. So
yes,
just like, ugh, it's just disappointing to see. And I'll also be following the story, just like, I hope they come up with a solution.
I know.
All the whiskeys to them as they try to sort it out.
For real. It's expensive to use the screening tools, and they're not also foolproof. You know, there are screening tools, but like, again, it's not that simple. So yeah, this is a thorny, complicated problem, and we'll see what happens. But definitely sending good thoughts for the Clark's World folks for sorting it out. All right. Well, that's our news. Let's take another sponsor break, and then we will get into our book club discussion of Lone Women by Victor Laval.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right. Okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of a Finnish pharmaceutical genius, Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few, which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society, or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. I'm so excited to talk about this book. It is such a ride.
Such a ride. I did not know what to expect going in. Like, you know, I did the thing of reading as little as possible about it. Of course, I saw the synopsis, the publisher's synopsis, but that was about it. And so I was really surprised and delighted and horrified by everything I found in this book.
Correct. That's the correct list of emotions and feelings. So yeah, to sum up very briefly, it is set in 1915 Montana. Our main character, although this is a multiple perspective story, y'all. So yes, keep that in mind. But our initial main character is Adelaide Henry, who is a young Black woman who is leaving California, a very settled Black farming community in California, to go to Montana as a lone woman, quote unquote. This was like a known term, to be a homesteader. And she's got a giant trunk. that's locked and super heavy and very alarmed about the trunk. You start out the story knowing that her family has died. Her parents have died horribly, like blood everywhere. She's burnt the house down. You don't know what's going on with her, except for that it's very bad and she needs to get out of town. And so she's going to Montana. And then we get along to Montana where we meet, you know, a bunch of other characters who occasionally we get POV from, which was, I think, a really smart and interesting choice.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, Victor Lavalle is the author of a lot of books that we love. The Ballad of Black Tom is one I am always recommending. The Changeling is one of the most horrifying books I've ever read in my life. he's also written comics, including Destroyer, which is a take on Frankenstein. And he is one of the only horror authors that I read. And I've been trying to remember, like, how did that happen? Like, how did
Fascinating, because the Changeling is particularly gruesome. And so I'm like, I don't think that clocked in my head, but I mean, if you had to choose one, I think this Lavalle is like a great one.
Well, I think what happened is somebody gave me The Devil in Silver.
Yeah.
And didn't tell me it was horror. And The Devil in Silver was scary, but was manageable for me. So then I picked up The Ballad of Black Tom, which, same, scary, absolutely scary, but really manageable. And I really loved the character work and, like, the settings. You know, it's a lot of New York City stuff and the outer boroughs. And then I was like, oh, I can read really Victor Lavalle. And then I read The Changeling. And I was like, I regret, but I couldn't put it down. It was so awful. I mean, it's the reason I have, like, the computer, like, camera screen setup that I do, like, it's
good
tinfoil hat. Like, oh, that's a rough book, y'all. Really rough. So, but, you know, now that I've started reading him, I don't feel like I can stop, I guess, is what's happening here. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, Sharifa.
Yeah, I think that because he's such a reliably wonderful writer, which is, you know, when you talked about this book for our most anticipated for this year, and you had pointed it out to me, like, both of us were obviously very excited, because anytime you see something come out from Victor Lavalle, you know you're going to get into something good. And I mean, this one, as far as gore goes, it was quite gory, but there were also moments that kind of balanced out the really terrible, just like ghastly, explicitly violent bits. So I think, as somebody who reads just like an abundance of horror, perhaps I can't say this for other people, but to me it felt like maybe that helps a little with this read. It's not like just nonstop gore fest.
Yes. Yes. I know. I think you're right. I think, like Ballad of Black Tom and Devil in Silver, this was a manageable level of horror for me because it was balanced out. There's some amazing character work, setting work, and not that darker horror doesn't have those things, but like you spend time out of the horror enough that when you go back into it, you're like, okay, just I'm like white knuckling it, but I'm like, I know that I'm going to get through it because there's going to be like light on the other side of the tunnel. And I also think it's the approach of the author that makes a difference to me, right? Like unremitting, unrelentless darkness is not going to work for me. I can't do it. I can't stay in that space for extended periods of time. And so authors who do that are not authors I can read. Whereas Lavalle finds these moments of brightness, finds these moments of, you know, even if it's like not fully redemption, it feels like an upward moment. And that is what helps me as well. So yeah, like if you are not a horror reader, I think this one, again, with we'll give content warnings, obviously, but like I think it's manageable in a way that like The Changeling, I'm very careful about who I recommend The Changeling to. That book is rough. So, yeah. So just to give those content warnings, obviously, racism is a theme in this book, right? Where we have a Black female character, misogyny, also a theme, side note. Mm-hmm. As Sharifa said, there's extremely graphic violence against all kinds of people, animals, creatures. Like, it is, nobody is safe from violence. There's also homophobia and transphobia and faked disability in this book. So those are all things that you will want to keep in mind. But I think for the most part, you know, we'll talk later about stuff that didn't quite work for us. I think for the most part, it's all handled extremely well.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. So... yeah, we kind of covered why we chose it for book club, but I know you have some thoughts about this book versus some of his other books, yeah. And I'm really curious about that.
It felt really different to me in a way that I've been struggling to put my finger on, and as I was prepping for this, I was like, I wonder if it's just the setting. Like, he's done historical horror before as well as contemporary, but generally his stories take place in, you know, New York City and the outer boroughs. So, and this is obviously like deeply historical and set in Montana. Like, that's new for my experience of reading Lavelle. And I wonder how much of that feeling of like, well, this is so different from his other books is just that. Like, maybe I just got used to his amazing depictions of New York City and the boroughs. And this is like, that's what's different about this. I don't know. Do you have feelings about this book compared to the other book?
I felt the same. Yeah. Mm. I've read, you know, The Changeling and the Ballad of Black Tom and also Destroyer. And I think maybe the only thing I can think of, because I felt the same but didn't like give it a ton of thought, but I think this is the first book I personally have read of his where most of the perspectives are women.
Oh, like, that's true.
Almost completely straight through, like, this is an entourage cast, you yeah. know, like, multiple perspectives. And the women's voices are so strong in this. And their stories are, they make up the brunt of this mm-hmm. book. So I was like, oh, this is, like, the first time I've read a book by Lavelle where, you know, there were so many women characters and we were mostly hearing their perspectives.
That's a good point. I did not think about yeah. that, but you're right. Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. And I enjoyed it. Like, I love a posse of women and in yes. the Old West and like, yeah, give me that. I'm good with it.
100%. 100%. Well, let's talk about some of those characters. I mean, you have a great pick for your favorites. I'm honestly very hard pressed to pick, though, because it is an ensemble cast. And aside from like the actual villains, I really loved almost everyone. Not everyone, but almost, because they all had these, you know, they're flawed. They're morally gray. They're complicated. They are very shaped by their circumstances, sometimes in like super not great ways, but they all have so much heart. And I'm saying all, but again, there are like notable exceptions to this. I'm not going to say who because I don't want to give spoilers, but there are notable exceptions to my feelings about this. But yeah, I thought everybody was so great. So it was very hard for me to narrow down like an actual favorite. But I support your picks, obviously. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I found it extremely challenging as well. And I forced myself to choose a couple of characters. So I wasn't like choosing one even. Yeah. But I forced myself to choose by saying, okay, well, if I got to have a little bit more backstory or just story in general about a character or a couple of characters, who would I want to hear about first, at least? Mm. And so I chose Birdie and Fiona, who I noted I thought of as the power couple.
Oh, yes.
In this book, because they are both just like, I'm so fascinated with their story. So Birdie is a Black woman who lives in this setting in Montana and has made a really lucrative business for herself with beer. I thought that the fact that she runs a brewery was really cool. And she just seems like so no nonsense. And like she has some really potent feelings about certain things, which you find out about later in the book. And I won't get into too much here yet. And then there's Fiona, who's Birdie's partner, who's a Chinese American woman and dealing with xenophobia and racism toward Chinese American people in the Old West, which was rampant. And also the two of them are just like, they have to have this relationship in mostly secret, and they don't get to just publicly show affection for each other, but they're so strongly supportive of each other. And I thought that they're like the little bits that you get about their relationship were just like so wonderful. And I just wanted more of that. So that's how I chose that.
Oh, I love that approach. I will 100% co-sign that. I would read the bejesus out of more Birdie and Fiona perspectives. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, one of the things I loved about this generally is that because we have this multi-perspective setup, we get to be inside of the perspectives of folks who are often overlooked or ignored characters in Old West stories, which like we knew going into that Victor Laval was going to, right? Like I was like, yeah, he's going to give us characters that we don't normally get. And we did. We got multiple Black and Asian American characters. We got a Mexican American couple at one point towards the end. There are multiple queer characters. There's overlapping intersections of identity. We do only get one Native character, a Métis trader named Clement Cardinal, and he's great. But that was one of my like, oh, I wish there was just a little bit more acknowledgement. Or even a lot more, but like more. And it's not fair to put all of that on Laval. This is something I want to see in all weird Western stories or all Westerns, is more of that acknowledgement of the original inhabitants and their stories. So, you know, that's just like an overall note I have for all Western stories that I read for the most part.
Yeah.
But I did think, you know, the characters that we did get, yeah, they were like, it's like a kaleidoscope of people, which I really loved.
I did too. And yeah, there was that one moment where Clement Cardinal was basically like, because this is a homesteading story, it's about homesteaders. And he was like, well, yeah, like whose land do you think that was that the homesteaders got? And I was like, yep. So I also really appreciated the diversity of characters in this story. And, you know, I'm somebody who has in the past avoided stories about the Old West and homesteader stories. I used to read more of that stuff for young readers as a, you know, middle grade reader. The stories we all know about homesteading, I don't even have to name them here.
No, but yeah.
But then later on in life, of course, I was, I realized how complicated and problematic some of those stories were. And it just like really turned me off from them. And stories about the Old West, I just generally really I never really got into them because, you know, they tended to center white men. And I just didn't find anything for myself in there. So I was like, when I was reading, I started reading this and realizing where we were going and that this was going to be a homesteader story. I was like, I would not even have thought about ever coming across or reading a story where Black and queer and Native people, like people in the margins were centered in one of these stories. And it made it so much more inviting to me. And I was able to kind of put aside my distaste for stories of the Old West.
Legit.
Yeah. So that it did a lot for me, this story. I want more of this.
I know. You know what's so funny, too, is that when I started reading it, I was like, I have read a weird Western short story about a locked trunk. I know I have. And I could not for the life of me Google it up. I cannot figure out where I read it. I thought for a minute that it was Karen Russell's short story Proving Up, which is in Vampires in Lemon Grove, but that is a homesteading story, a horror homesteading story, but it's not about a trunk. It's about a window. And if anybody listening is like, oh yeah, I read that too, and you know what it is, like, please send us an email, sffyeah@bookriot.com, because I'm like, I know this is a thing that I've read before, and I'm so curious, like, what is it about the giant steamer trunk that's locked and cannot be opened that is so, like, where did it come from? Like, what was the first one? Like, this is a thing, because I know I've read more than one. And so it's driving me a little batty that I can't think of what that story was, so I can, like, start tracing sort of the trope lineage, as it were. Like, I'm here for it. I love it. I just can't figure out where the other one I read was. So
I don't know if this is one of those, like, moments, that phenomena where everybody thinks that something was in existence and whatever. But I feel like that sounds really familiar.
Right?
Even as somebody who hasn't obviously read a lot of stories about the Old West, it sounds super familiar. And I do wonder if maybe I just read something about a locked trunk that had nothing to do with the Old West. Yeah. But it sounds like I feel like somebody out there has to know.
Somebody's got to know.
Can we also talk about this moment, because you put it in the notes, but I also loved it with the Birdie and Adelaide hair moment.
Oh my gosh. I got chills, y'all. Like, there's this beautiful, I mean, really funny, actually, moment where Birdie calls out Adelaide's hair and when they, like, first meet, I think. And then there's a callback later when Birdie, like, finally shows up and is like, all right, now we're going to fix your hair. And I was just like, this is such a beautiful, mundane, but, like, all, again, like, feels like a very overlooked moment, right? Like, black hair needs a very specific kind of care.
Yeah. And it's a thing that I think, you know, with a story where a black woman especially is in this setting, I think I would have automatically just assumed we wouldn't hear anything about her hair, but it is such a, I was just like, I am so glad LaValle included this scene. And there was, like, a really maybe bittersweet moment where, you know, Birdie was doing Adelaide's hair and she, like, slipped into her memory and thinking about her mom doing her hair and the comfort of that, and, like, had to stop herself from stroking Birdie's ankle or something like that.
Yes. Because,
and I was like, oh, this is, like, so real and so good. And I just adored that moment in the story and that it happened between Birdie and Adelaide, because what better way for two black women to bond than to be in this survival mode and be like, your hair, girl. You gotta do something about that.
I felt like a lot of readers would feel very seen by that moment. Like, obviously not me specifically, but, like, yes, my understanding of it. So I was so glad I heard. Also, side note, in, like, talking about tiny moments, I'm obsessed with Adelaide's horse, Obadiah. Like, I'm obsessed with Adelaide and her horse. Like, I loved, there's, like, these, again, this is what LaValle is so good at. There's these small moments that give you these, like, character depths without, you know, having to do a ton of work to get you there. They're just there on the page. And I loved Obadiah and Adelaide.
They were so great. This big old clunky horse. Yeah. Like, Adelaide is, like, a very tall, very, you know, strapping, strong woman. So, like, physically, it just made so much sense to have this, you know, big, I don't know if strong is the word for this horse.
A little bit like broken down, like, you know, sort of like cheap because nobody else wants him. But like, he's here to do the thing.
Yeah, he's doing his best. Yeah. And Obadiah is just a great name for a horse. It really gives you a sense of who this horse is.
Yes, yes. Loved it. There's so many moments like that. I mean, just so many great moments between two characters or between a character and an animal or whatever. Give that depth of feeling that I really loved. All right, so should we get into spoilers? Now is the time, I feel like.
I think so. We've given a lot of non-spoilery stuff, so yes. I think we're allowed.
All right,
now. So
this is the moment, y'all. If you don't want to get spoiled on some things, turn off the podcast. We'll talk to you next time.
So, yes. Things we didn't love as much.
Yes.
So, I actually have one I also didn't even think to put in here, and it just occurred to me as we were talking. Mm. But, like, I think that this was the thing that spoke to me about things that surprised me about Birdie's character, where once we discover who Elizabeth is, what the secret in the trunk is.
Right, who the creature in the trunk is. Yes.
Yes, and so there is a creature in the trunk, and the name of this creature is Elizabeth, and it turns out that Elizabeth is Adelaide's sister. And so there's this big conflicting moment. We know that Adelaide has felt all sorts of ways about this secret her family has kept. Elizabeth, who is, you know, who was born Adelaide's twin, I believe. Am I remembering that correctly?
Twin, yep.
Yeah, born Adelaide's twin, but looks very different, is, you know, what they're describing, you know, is this is supposed to be the monster in the trunk moment, and Elizabeth is the monster. And so Adelaide has all sorts of feelings about, like, did I not do enough to protect Elizabeth? Mm-hmm. And I was also, like, as I was reading this, I was, like, internally disturbed because I was, like, I don't even know the answer to this.
Right.
What do people do in this situation? And Birdie obviously had very strong feelings of, like, how could you do this?
Yes.
Like, how could you, your own sister and your parents' own daughter, how could you treat her like this? Of course, later on, she experiences the interaction with Elizabeth and is like, oh, you were talking about a literal monster.
Right.
But that was, like, that whole thing was purposefully disturbing and
extremely uncomfortable. And, like, I think, and that was one of the things I loved about the ending, actually, is that, like, Elizabeth and Adelaide become a duo, and, like, they are, like, despite, you know, Elizabeth being, like, a legit, like, feeding on the blood of humans and animals monster, is an accepted and, like, protective part of this community. And I just love how it complicates, you know, the creature feature narrative. Like, and I think sometimes, I will say, I think sometimes, you know, stories will, quote unquote, redeem their villain by giving them, like, a horrific backstory. It's not their fault that they're monsters, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And I think, you know, Lavelle is shining light on how Elizabeth was made in certain ways to be the monster that she is by the behavior of others, but also, like, she is a monster. Like, she's a legit monster. Yeah. So, like, it's both. And I appreciate, like, again, so much nuance. Like, I think I appreciate that it's both, that she is a monster and also she has value to this community at the end, and, like, for better or worse, like, for good or ill, like, maybe it's right and maybe it's not, but it is what it is. And that sort of moral gray area is, like, I like to roll around in it, you know, because it is so uncomfortable. But I think it's important because so many things are not starkly good or bad. And it's important to, like, get your brain around, like, able to think about that, in ways that are whether fictional or in real life, because that's where the work is to me. Like, that's where the work of finding the best path forward, the most right path, is, because there's never one path that's like 100% right, I think. Often, anyway. Like, obviously there are exceptions, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You aren't given the answer here. Like, no, you are presented with the circumstances as they happen, and it's up to you to figure out like what your feelings are and what is right in this situation and what is wrong and what is like neither. Just is what it is.
Yeah, like Joab's storyline, man. I was real uncomfortable with that one. I still don't know how I feel about it, to be perfectly honest. I like really don't know how I feel about the ending that he gets. Like, woo, it's hashtag complicated, y'all. Hashtag complicated.
I was literally walking around yesterday thinking about this discussion coming up, and I was like, would I say on a podcast that I kind of wished that Joab
yeah,
had met his unlucky end?
Listen, I feel you though. I'm torn about it. I'm actively torn about it. I'm like, do I think he deserved that ending? Do I think there's anything about like deservingness that's like in, you know what I mean? There's so many questions. And this is the thing that Laval does. He's like, well, what do you think? I don't know. You tell me. Like, it's like, oh God. Woo. It's spicy. It's spicy.
Yeah, it is. And the moment with, one of the other things that made me uncomfortable. So this isn't like, it just made me uncomfortable. The stuff with Sam at the end where, you know, they basically, I can't remember if they dead named Sam.
They both dead name Sam and like actively misgender, actively like force, you know, different clothing on Sam. And he's like, you know, I think this is again where the multiple perspectives get sticky. Sorry to interrupt. About this too. But like, because you're in the head of somebody who sees Sam as a girl when Sam is not a girl. And so there's this unquestioning assumption by that perspective that you know is wrong, but it's unquestioned within that perspective. And then, but you also get like other perspectives that fully acknowledge that Sam is a boy. And so it's so, I mean, I'm getting like weird, like dissonance chills just talking about it. I think it's very tough. I think it's very hard to read. It's very uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah. That I hadn't thought about the perspective shift there, but that makes a lot of sense because I had to kind of remind myself that this is like the character speaking, the way they were approaching Sam. Ugh. And I had a really hard time with that piece of it. And it was supposed to be that way. And I just, it was tough.
It was rough. It was really rough. Yeah. One of the things that I had on, and I was curious if you felt this too, very occasionally somebody will curse, like use like the F-bomb or something else. And I will preface this with, I have seen all of Deadwood. I know that there was cursing in the Old West, right? Like, that's not my problem. What was weird about it in my reading of this book was that it was so sparse that when it happened, I found it really jarring. And I think that was probably a deliberate choice. I'm sure it was a deliberate choice for emphasis. And it works as emphasis, but it also knocked me out of the story just a little bit. And I was wondering if that was true for you as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know. It might have been when there was cursing, but there were moments for me that felt like it almost slipped into some more contemporary sounding language generally. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure because, you know, with weird fiction and with stuff that isn't really like our reality, I don't always know, like, is that intentional because this is not the world we're living in, or maybe I just don't know enough about the Old West and language that was used back then. Maybe that was just how people talked. I don't know. So I couldn't figure out if like I was just reading too much into it, but I was curious at least about like, so are we going into the realm of like, this is just contemporary language that's occasionally being used here. And, you know, that's just part of this world.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So maybe that's part of what I felt in terms of the sort of sparseness and jarring feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. Interesting things to think about. So much interesting things to think about.
So much. But I just loved this book. I blew through it. I sort of saw it because I read this as an ebook, and I saw it and I saw all the parts and chapters. And, you know, like I struggle with longer books these days. And I was like, oh, am I going to be able to finish this in time? I was like, I could not put it down. And I got through it so quickly because I was just enjoying getting to know these characters. I just really loved this book.
Yay!
Yeah!
So yeah, go out and get it. It's good. We'll be curious to hear other folks' thoughts about these spoilery matters and other matters. And also, if you have read A Locked Trunk Weird Western, please email sffia@bookriot.com. I'm dying to know what it was that I read, because I know I read one. All right. Well, that's our book club discussion. So thanks for coming on that journey with us. SFFIA is sound edited by Caitlin Brame. Many thanks to her for making us sound great each and every episode. For more recommendations, you can check out bookriot.com. You can find our other podcasts at bookriot.com/listen. And don't forget to check out The Deep Dive, bookriot.substack.com. And yeah, thanks for listening. As always, email us about Locked Trunk Westerns or whatever at sffia@bookriot.com. You can review us on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Helps other sci-fi fantasy fans to find this show. And speaking of finding us, Sharifa, where are you?
I'm on Instagram at szainabwilliams, S-Z-A-I-N-A-B Williams.
And you can find me on Tumblr at jennirl, J-E-N-N-I-R-L. And yeah, we will talk to you next time.